I'd like to go ahead and call Senate Finance Committee to order. Time is 7 minutes after 9 a.m., February 1st, 2010. Joining me today is my co-chair, Senator Hoffman, Senator Ellis, Senator Olson, Senator Thomas, Senator Egan, and Senator Huggins is traveling, and he may join us if the planes arrive in time for the meeting. I'd like to welcome everybody back for the second week at Senate Finance. And as we continue to build a base of what we're going to be working on for the next 80 days, we're going to continue our review of the state's fiscal and economic condition. Today's presentation will be brought to you by the Department of Revenue, and the Treasury Division is going to update our savings accounts and our budget reserves. And we're going to go ahead on Wednesday. We're going to shift a little more on the economic conditions around the state with the Deputy Commissioner for Aviation, duty task is managing Ted Stevens International Airport, which is kind of almost like a leading economic indicator for the state, with a third of Anchorage's economy tied to the airport. We're also going to have the railroad, and the railroad, for those watching, is directly tied to airport landings and refueling of the large planes. So we'll have a good feel for what's going on at the airport with tonnage landings, number of landings, different carriers, and fuel. Also, it substantially impacts the railroad and loads coming out of the refineries that we have. We'll bring the refinery issue to the table sometime later in the session when we get into a little more detail on the oil and gas issues. I thought it'd be clear just in the beginning to have the airport and the railroad. And then on Friday, we're going to have a presentation on the state's bonding and debt instruments, what's available to the state and its current position of where we're at and how much authority is out there unused. And other issues, we need to have a good understanding of what we're dealing with when we talk about financing some of our large capital ventures, if it's building roads, bridges, or what have you. And also, we'll have discussions tied in with the fiscal position of the state, whether we should just be paying cash, or we should go out and bond ourselves, impacting the future operating account. That's something that the committee needs to give some guidance to the administration on where they're comfortable. And with that, today I'd like to invite Mr. Patrick Galvin, Commissioner of Revenue, who's been before us many times, to go ahead and call on his support staff as he needs, sees fit, to give us the presentation today on our savings and fiscal position.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Pat Galvin, the Commissioner, Department of Revenue, and with me is Jerry Burnett, the Deputy Commissioner, who is responsible for the Treasury side. And also with us today is Gary Bader, who's the Chief Investment Officer for the Department of Revenue. Jerry will be the one providing you with the background on the various savings accounts, and Gary and I are here to answer questions as they come up. So with that, I'll turn it over to Jerry.
Good morning. For the record, Jerry Burnett, I'm the Deputy Commissioner of the Department of Revenue. First account that I want to bring up here is the General Fund and other non-segregated investments. This is the big operating account for the state of Alaska. Currently has a market value as of 12/31 of just over $6 billion. $6,184,000,000. It's fairly similar today, I believe. I didn't look this morning, but I looked Friday, and it was right at $6 billion. This is where the money flows in from taxes, and it flows out to make payments for various things. That $6 billion is not money that you can spend. It doesn't mean it's available for you to spend. Approximately $1 billion of that $6 billion are in what we call Type 1 MOU accounts, Memorandum of Understanding accounts, and that includes funds such as the Alaska Housing Capital Income Account, which we invest for the Alaska Housing Capital Income Corporation, which has $358 million in it as of December 31st. It includes the Bridge Education Loan Fund. It includes, you know, things like Department of Law Legal Services Settlement Funds, the Oil and Gas Hazardous Substance Release and Prevention Funds are all held in that. Those are not funds that are, some of those funds are generally available to spend, some of them are not. There's about $1 billion that are in those types of funds. Those type one funds keep their interest at the end of the year, or earnings at the end of the year, and they stay in those funds. Then another, just over $2 billion of that $6 billion, $2.195 billion as of December 31st, are in what we call Type 2 Memorandum of Understanding accounts. And that are accounts such as the Statutory Budget Reserve account, which has $1 billion in it, the Municipal Capital Project Matching Fund, the Alaska Capital Income Fund, which is money from the Amerada Hess settlement, which flows into here and is held until it's appropriated by the legislature. The Marine Highway System Fund, those are accounts that earn earnings to the general fund, and the earnings from those accounts stay in the general fund or move to the general fund. So of that almost $6.2 billion at year end, a little over $3.3 billion of that is in Memorandum of Understanding accounts, not in the unrestricted general fund. The balance, which is just under $3 billion, general fund, on an accounting basis, remember the general fund starts each year at zero. On a cash basis, it has about, because you've had repayments to the CBR, and other than subfunds, the unrestricted general fund starts on an accounting basis at zero at the beginning of the year. So that $3 billion is money that's come in this year. It's money that has come in previous years, been appropriated for other purposes, and has not been spent yet. So it's like your checking account with income, and this doesn't show the in and out, the obligations and the liabilities and the receivables.
Mr. Burnett, if you could just take a moment and tie in the reverse sweep that goes on.
Okay.
We've got a new member here that has been indoctrinated into the sweeps, and okay, some of us might have forgotten. So
since 1993 or so, I think approximately 1993, there have been borrowings from the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund to balance the budget over a period of years. There hasn't been one since 2003 or 2004 now, but over that time about $5 billion was borrowed. So at the end of each fiscal year, any money in the general fund that's left over, unappropriated, is moved into the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund by operation of the Constitution. That's Article 9, Section 17, I believe, which requires a repayment. And the Division of Finance, when they do the accounting at the end of the year, do that. Every year in the operating budget or the capital budget, whichever budget bill it's in, it's usually would be in the operating budget, although I can remember years when they were combined and such, so I can't say that that's always been in the operating budget. There's a provision that appropriates money that's paid to the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund from the general fund by automatic operation of the constitutional provision back to the working capital funds, the subfunds of the general fund. And so at the end of this past fiscal year, there was enough money in the general fund to pay off the debt to the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund, but the legislature had appropriated money back to things like the Oil and Hazardous Substance Release Prevention Funds, the Working Alaska Marine Highway System Funds, et cetera, so that those working capital funds would actually have money in them. So after those were repaid, then the general fund, the unrestricted general fund, would have a zero balance, but those funds would have their balances restored, and there's a debt to the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund from the general fund of about $401 million. Is that what you wanted?
Basically, yes. It sounds convoluted, but but when we have to sweep it to zero, so we can't run those accounts with no balance going forward in the next fiscal year.
Right.
So we reverse the sweep in the next paragraph virtually, so we meet the technical requirements and still be able to operate the state.
Okay.
Otherwise, we'd be stripping out a lot of those accounts, and then we'd be in a big political circle to try to deal with that issue. So, but that game is going to, I shouldn't call it a game, that structure is going to change with the eventual payoff of the CBR.
Okay.
I'll have you go ahead and continue, Mr. Burnett. From time to time, I'll probably stop you for definitions and other things.
That's fine. If you can play stump me, or you can play stump the commissioner. And if you stump both of us, then we'll go to our lifeline in the back.
Okay. Well, hopefully. The main thing is that people, you know, watching at home in the committee, of course, understand what information is being put on the table.
Okay.
But I'd like you to, before you go to the next slide, before you're done with this, is to define some of the terms that are in the middle of the pie.
Okay. Pie there, which shows us 100% fixed income, so that would be debt instruments, bonds, generally. Short-term bonds. What's the duration on short-term? Okay. So the short-term are 1 to 3 year instruments, and the intermediate term is
why don't we have Mr. Bader come forward?
Can
I make it smoother?
Sorry.
Feed my chair to here.
If you could introduce yourself for the record, even though we've in your face many times.
Thank you, Senator. My name is Gary Bader. I'm the Chief Investment Officer. Actually, what is depicted as short term up there is cash, which is 13 months or less, and what we call intermediate term. Many people call short term, but intermediate term is 1 to 3 year.
So we're using less than 13 months or less for short term and 1 to 3 for intermediate?
Yes. It could be 16 months, but it's generally 13 months. We can go out, cash funds are generally 13 months or less, and we can go out to 16.
I think in the public they refer to that a lot of times as a money market account.
Yes.
Which is a term probably more people are familiar with.
I would agree.
Okay. And then at the bottom, you'll see, you know, what the market values were below the pie chart as of 12/31/2007, 12/31/2008. 2008 was a great year for tax collections, as you'll recall. And so then 2009, end of year. The year-to-date earnings would be calendar year 2009. The fiscal year-to-date is from July 1 through December 31st of 2009. Three-year actuals at 4.68%, a five-year actuals of 4.31%, with a forecast earnings of 3.6%. So these funds have actually, over the past 5 years, done well relative to benchmarks and to their and to what their expectations are.
And then if we could, when we come back and and visit this issue, which we're going to do with more detail in the future. We'll have you plug in the 1 year, and maybe you can even go back in and we'll take a more refined look at the benchmark, because there is a substantial spread between the benchmark, especially on year to date.
Right.
We'd like to take a look at what the benchmark is, how it's put together, and how the comparisons are done. And, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On your forecast of 3.6, is that the fiscal year estimates?
Yes.
So the year-to-date is 1.6, and you're forecasting 3.6 year-to-date, so there's going to be substantial earnings for the last 6 months of this fiscal
year. Well, fiscal year-to-date, at one point to the chair, to Senator Hoffman, fiscal year-to-date, which is represents 6 months of earnings. So if you just were to annualize that to 1 year, that would be 3.2. So it's a little bit below the forecast, but it's not substantially below the forecast.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead and continue.
So that's the general fund and related. The next slide shows.
If we can just stop there just for a second. So there's we are reclassifying about $700 million in general funds or other state funds to
right.
general funds. What impact, if any, does that reclassification scenario have on the Treasury?
Mr. Chair, that will have no effect on our investment policies, performance, or how we do things. We already identify in our accounting system each of these to what their purpose is, and they're all part of the general fund from an investment. All those funds that you're talking about would be still invested exactly the same as they are. Okay, the next slide shows the two components of the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund. The main account, which might be kind of a misnomer because the sub-account's larger than the main account, and so I don't know that we actually would define it that way if we were starting from here. That is the available money invested in intermediate term, broad market, and short term securities, moderate risk. Market value on that, as you can see, has gone from $2.5 billion at the end of 2007 to $3.2 billion at the end of 2008 to $4.2 billion at the end of 2009. Most of that growth has occurred from appropriations to it. I believe settlements to it in that period are in the range of between $500 and $600 million. And the rest of it, of the growth beyond earnings, is appropriations that were made by the legislature to that, or sweep at the end of last fiscal, some from the sweep at the end of last fiscal year.
And can you just run around the pie and touch us again on the definitions? Because there's a new one on here called broad market. And
Senator, the broad market represents what used to be called the Lehman Aggregate Fixed Income Benchmark, which is now known as the Barclays Aggregate. The composition of that aggregate is generally mortgages, treasury bills, corporate bonds, and other asset-backed securities. It changes, the composition changes from time to time as the market changes, but that is the benchmark that we're trying to meet with the broad market. The intermediate is the 1-3 Merrill Lynch government index, and short term is money market or cash.
And then on the broad market, is that active or are you indexing or what do you?
It is actively managed.
Is all of this actively managed? Is any of it indexed?
All of this is actively managed.
Well, Mr. Chair, for fixed income securities in the commissioner's funds, I believe we're pretty much all actively managed. We've managed about $16 billion of fixed income in-house in the Treasury Division.
But I think as we go through this, it's nice to, we're going to, you know, work on a separation of what's active, what's passive.
I know external and internal.
I understand the, you know, the presentation here is extremely high level, but as we build on these, build on this process, we'll have some of those issues at the table in more detail later. But I'm just a little concerned that we don't get too high level here, because one of the things, I mean, if we look to the presentation, and we went through the worst financial markets in 70 years, but it's not even reflected in the presentation. And so we need to be a little careful on what, you know, we don't fly too high Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm assuming that yield is actually only interest.
Mr. Chair, the returns reflected here represent interest earnings plus losses or gains from market movement of the value of the security.
Fair enough. And if I may, the benchmarks are?
The benchmarks for the broad market were the Barclays Ag. For the intermediate term is the Merrill Lynch 1-3 Government Index. And cash is the 90-day Treasury bill.
Thank you.
So looking at the returns on the main account, the year-to-date, which is calendar 2008, of 4.23, the fiscal year-to-date of 2.46, 3-year actuals of 5.56, and 5-year actuals of 4.81. Except for the 3-year actuals, it's outperformed the benchmarks in every term. And the forecast of 4.18 based on Callan market capital assumptions and the benchmarks, we are above that fiscal year to date based on this, with the 2.46.
And do you happen to have the 1 years with you, Mr. Burnett, by chance?
No.
You can give them to us.
But we can get them for you.
Right. Okay. So.
Okay, the other part of the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund, which is more of an investment fund, it's been treated more as an investment fund. It was created by the legislature in, I think, 1998 or so. And as I recall, the discussion at the time was that the legislature was thinking about borrowing some money and they wanted to make sure their investments were earning a higher rate than what they were borrowing. Was the discussion here in Senate, the idea came out of the Senate Finance Committee at that time. And so it was, you couldn't, you know, set up a fund and invest it, but you had money and you were already investing it. The first year that the subaccount was invested, it lost about 25%. That was back when it was created. And it had $400 million in it. It went down significantly the first year, but it did come back a little bit. If you look at that, it's fixed income, which is a broad market, the same as the broad market in the main account. It has international equities, which is an IFA index fund.
I want to define that.
Europe, Asia,
Far East Index,
and Far East Index, and
I should just a clarification: the international is a IFA index, but is also 80% active investment. So it's index and active.
Yeah, so it's basically an 80-20 split.
Yes.
And then the domestic equity, go ahead, Gary.
Domestic equity is Russell 3000 index.
and that's all indexed.
Yes. And what is the Russell 2000? I mean, people are watching this. We got to make sure, you know, we try to have it so everybody, non-financial people, know what we're talking about here at the table, because it's their money.
Sorry, Senator. The Russell Index is an index of approximately 3,000 companies with the highest, I should say, domestic market companies with the highest market value. So Russell takes a look at the 3,000 largest American companies and constructs an index based on those. Now, there's some things that they leave out, I believe, but by and large, it's the 3,000 largest companies.
In the U.S.
In the U.S.
So it's a much broader index than, say, the Dow or Standard & Poor's, which are a smaller number of companies that are selected. So this is mirrors the domestic economy more nearly than the other indexes.
Then the Dow Jones Industrial Index, which is industrial stocks, and the S&P 500, which is the 500 biggest stocks, we're broadening it out to 3,000.
The 3,000 biggest stocks. It's a broad index.
Thank you, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Again, on the forecast, is that the fiscal year number?
That is the forecast for this asset allocation based on an annual basis, based on the Callan capital market.
So going back to the general fund, you had stated that forecast was for the fiscal year, and this one is for the calendar year?
Well, no, fiscal year, excuse me.
Oh,
I'm sorry.
For the fiscal year. And going back to the general fund, that was year-to-date, fiscal year is 1.6. Mm-hmm. And you have 3.6 for your forecast, which you explained was the 1.6 was, you know, for 6 months, so that's 3.2, so there's a growth factor there of 0.4%, but if you use those same math there, why the big discrepancy on your year-to-date of on your high risk of 16.61 down to 7.87?
Senator, the biggest reason for the discrepancy is that the high risk funds is predominantly stocks, which have had far greater returns and also sometimes suffer from greater volatility.
But I'm looking at that and saying that if you take into consideration the 16.6 for year-to-date for the first 6 months and your forecast is 7.8 for the year, you're saying the stock markets are going to substantially lose funds?
To the chair, to Senator Hoffman, we're not saying that. What we're saying is that based on the assumption on an annual basis, we would expect this asset allocation to earn 7.87% year to year. We have actually earned through half the year almost 17% with it. It's unlikely that this year it's going to lose another 8% and then get down to the 8%. But that's what you would expect it if you were modeling year to year. We're not making a forecast for what the next 6 months will bring in. But that was the forecast at the beginning of the period based on the asset allocation.
Well, if you say forecast, I assume that that's the forecast. It says in bold black letters here that the forecast is going to be 7.87.
Right. And that was the forecast at the beginning of the fiscal year, not the forecast from today going forward. So it's done better than what was forecast.
The broad market has had a substantial rebound above what was expected by the forecast 8.88 or 7.87. But I think we're going to have some comparisons.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think that when you talk about forecast, I was assuming that that was the forecast for the next 6 months because we already know what happened in the last 6 months.
So we would
your forecast is the term or the duration of the forecast is for 12 months and not for the remaining 6 months.
That's correct. For each of these.
So even with that, you never updated your forecast for the next 6 months and left your forecast at a low 7.87, it would seem that your forecast would have been updated knowing the information that we have through the first 6 months.
Through the chair to Senator Hoffman. As we get through here, though, I think the last page in my presentation that will be put up is a showing our forecast income for the revenue sources book. And in that, we update with actuals, and we use the 7.8 earnings rate for the rest of the year as our forecast. So in the forecast money, the forecast that's in the revenue sources book, and which will be updated in spring, we use actuals to date plus forecast for the rest of the year. So that's the forecast on which OMB builds its budget.
So the forecast here presented to us today is obsolete?
In a sense, yes. That part would be obsolete.
If these numbers are end of fiscal year to date as of 12/31, correct?
That's correct. The
broad market's down like 5% so far this year. So I think it's very difficult. Rephrase that. When they come up with a expected return in the volatile equity markets, it's using a lot of historical data and Ouija boards into the future, and there's a lot of variance with that number. So, and it's very difficult to forecast the equity market 30 days or 60 days or 6 months out. One of the things I think we need to touch on here is, and there was a reference that you guys use Cal and associates, but maybe spin us up a little bit more on, you know, where the benchmarks are created. I think that's one of the subjects we'll work on coming, as future attractions, that integration with Cowan, because he clearly, from his testimony before, isn't involved in the CBR. So how help us bridge that gap a little bit.
Mr. Chair, the projections here, and perhaps the labeling should have said, projection for fiscal year, because that's what the forecast represents, were based upon the assumptions and the capital market assumptions that Cowan provides to us about this time each year. They haven't for the coming fiscal year, but we receive it about now. So about this time last year, Cowan presented to the Treasury and to the Retirement Board their projected earnings assumptions for each of the asset classes that are either solely or in combination represented in this report. Based on their inputs, the inputs were put into an optimizer, and the optimizer looked at certain combinations of risk and return, which could be projected or forecast. And this is a central tendency forecast. There's acknowledgement going into it that you could vary large degrees in terms of what actually happens. But this was the point of central tendency, and so it may present it as a forecast here. Probably should have said the FY 2010 projection.
I think if we could, I know you're going to get us the 1 year. If you could reach back to a 10-year, 10-year returns. You've got 3 and 5, and whenever it's available to the committee to have a 1, 3, 5, and a 10, kind of standard. But I think one of the things that we're going to find when we throw these historic numbers up through the permanent fund or our retirement account or even our savings account is the 10-year numbers are from the equity side is on the historical low side of rolling 10-year averages, and 5-year for that matter. So some people refer to it as the lost decade, but we'll, as far as returns, but it has a huge impact on the fiscal position of a lot of assets around this country. I think one of the things that we need to work on clarification too is, what kind of banded range of outputs in dollars we can expect given those allocations versus, for instance, on the 7.87% shown here under the higher risk side, it's got a fairly wide distribution potential in percentage and dollars than the 4.18 on the fixed income side. And we'll take a look at that more in detail as we go forward. Eventually, I think what we'll end up doing is having a presentation where we have all our major accounts in front of us at one time, the permanent fund, the retirement accounts at about $15 billion, permanent fund about $35 billion, and then we'll have our savings. And we'll have them all up on the screen at the same time so we can try to get a best feel as we can for all of the big pieces moving at once, what's going on with our exposure. Not that, and just don't misinterpret the comment, not that we have any interest in going into the retirement side, the TERS and PERS, but we do at some point, and hopefully it's several decades out, are going to have to take a hard look at the permanent fund as the oil basin and gas basin matures and dries out. Hopefully I'll be gone into the walk in the forest, never to return when that day comes.
You need to go on to the next.
Do we have any more questions? I have a couple more on this slide. If we could touch on the definitions. Last year there was a definition I see on the constitutional, on the right-hand side, the high-risk, moderate, long-term investments. Last year it was defined as a long-term savings account. And I'm just curious on the evolution of the definition or is that just...
I don't think there was any... I think we're still looking at it exactly the same way we were last year. It's still a statutory direction here as a five-year time horizon, and we're looking at it as a savings account. So I don't think there's any reason that the definition's changed other than I think it was someone else putting them on. So.
Okay. I think that's a discussion we need to have at the table as this evolves, what kind of mixture we want, and we'll work with,
right,
you know, with the administration on how that evolves or what we want to do. Because there has been discussion, not at the table directly, that I would call, but internally in the offices about should the state of Alaska hedge with oil prices, make future bets, either that the market oil prices going down or up to lock in particular revenue streams or protect ourselves against a declining oil price. There's also been a discussion that this is our hedging mechanism, large cash reserves, and that as we structure our oil tax to capture spikes, that we hold that revenue for when we have implosions in price. So it has a I guess there's more around the peripheral of this than just this chart. There's some policy calls that we need to reassure the administration on the direction that the finance committees want to go.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Olson.
As we look at the Constitution Budget Reserve, the high-risk portion, when you look at the market values, what's your explanation for the difference between the 2007 and 2008 actual amounts there? Because it looks like you've jumped 6.5% or 6.5 times in just that one year.
Through the chair, Senator Olson, in April of 2008, the legislature appropriated approximately $2.3 billion, I believe, to the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund in the supplemental budget. And that money was put into the subfund along with some other money, which was transferred from the main account. And there were other appropriations done at the end of the fiscal year. The legislature appropriated directly to the Constitutional Budget Reserve Fund in FY08 and 09, approximately $5 billion. And so that difference is an addition of $4.1 billion and then investment losses coming out. That.
So it's not all interest earnings and things like that?
No. What,
thank you very much, Mr. Chairman.
Quite the opposite.
Just the opposite. We're going to have that policy discussion amongst ourselves, not only on the broader sense as mentioned earlier, but even on the more narrower, on how that allocation, how we want this allocation. Even though those two pies here, they appear to be almost identical, and their value at 4.2 and 4.4 billion is pretty close, but we as a we may or may not be comfortable in that allocation, basically a 50-50. We may want to restructure that because we haven't set that policy at this table. And that's something I think we're going to work on doing. That's why you can't recollect it, because it wasn't in front of you, Senator Olson.
Mr. Chairman, so you're thinking is it having a more conservative approach to it?
Well, I'd like to have the information on the table, have a discussion amongst the committee members, and have a consensus, but if I had to take a wild guess, knowing the attitudes of my six colleagues, and there's probably a good chance that we're going to have a more conservative fiscal position structured for our savings account.
Thank you.
But we'll work that out in consensus after we have all the information on the table. Go ahead and continue.
Okay, the next fund that I wanted to draw your attention to is the Power Cost Equalization Fund, which is an endowment fund for paying power cost equalization. And it's set up with a 7% annual payout, so it's invested to achieve more than a 7% return. And you can see that it is structured with 20% international equity, 37% fixed income, and I believe that's the broad market again, and 43% domestic equity, which is at the Russell 3000. I believe that's, again, the Russell 3000.
So am I guessing this right, that this allocation is 63 equity, 37 fixed income is the same allocation as...
It's very similar to the constitutional, but the sub-account of the Constitutional Budget Reserve.
Okay. And just as one, I always want to fill in one little gap on before we go on Senator Olson's comment. We're behind on the high-risk end from our initial investment. We're 300, 400 million, how far under our way, and then the date of that estimate?
In the Constitutional Budget Reserve?
Yeah.
Today, we're about 300 million.
Okay, how about in January? The 1st of January, so these numbers match up, because we're talking about the January, December 31st numbers, I think, on the previous slide.
Okay, December 4.4, we should be 6. It's about a little over $200 million.
Okay.
Behind. It's approximately the same place that it was in June of 2008.
Right. Okay. And we'll deal with that in more detail later on, but just, I think that was kind of a gap in those, your earlier questions, Senator Olson.
Okay.
So we're working on closing that gap. But for the allocation here, now is that by just a fluke of Mother Nature, or was that intentional, this allocation? Or?
Well, the allocation is set to achieve the return necessary to pay out a 7% per year over time. So you're on the efficient frontier with the same type of assets. You're going to get very similar asset allocation.
And the time horizon of this account?
This is a time horizon which is long-term. We expect to be, there's no end to when we're paying PCE payments, I believe. So So this would be almost like a permanent fund.
Perpetuity.
In a sense, right. It's an endowment fund, the way it's structured.
Senator Hoffman.
Well, the permanent fund is permanent, and I would assume that the power cost equalization is permanent as well. But the permanent fund, or the permanent fund, the CBR, I mean, is long term, but you have two classes of moderate and high risk. Where do you get the direction to invest all of the power cost equalization funds on high risk?
The statute that's to the chair, to Senator Hoffman, the statute that sets up the endowment fund here requires a 7% annual payout. And in order to achieve that, it needs to be invested with assumptions that allow us to achieve a 7% return.
And in order to accomplish that, you feel that all of it has to be in high risk and not a substantial portion and the others on a more moderate investment scheme?
Well, through the chair of Senator Hoffman, 37% of the income of the fund is invested in fixed income securities. So it's not like it's 100% emerging market debt or something. It's fixed income securities, so broad index, which is a fairly conservative mix over time.
So investing in high risk, anything investing in high risk, you're assuming that you're going to make 7% and not higher than that?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, no. We're assuming that based on the asset mix that we have and the capital assumptions used, the central tendency over time will be to achieve the forecast earnings of about 7%. We could have invested, you could create a investment mix that would over time, a long period, be expect to earn a higher rate. And if you did, then you would have a much higher probability of loss in any given year. The higher rate of return you try to achieve, the higher probability of a loss in any given period.
Again, Mr. Chairman, I would like to see what the 10-year actuals are on this
right.
fund as well.
I think when we talk about payouts of sustaining payouts along with trying to not have an erosion of purchasing power. Several years ago, 5% was a real common number. Now there you'll see common numbers in the mid-4s and some of them maybe even approaching 4. I've had several conversations with Senator Hoffman over the last couple of years of the embedded problem we have with the power cost equalization payout at 7. Being unsustainable. And if you look at the 5-year actuals at 3.55, and I recognize that we've had some difficulties this last decade, but if we look at the 5-year number, excuse me, the 10-year number, I would expect the 10-year number to be less than 7. The payout, we'll have to wait and see what the 10-year number is when it comes forward, but clearly we have a policy discussion that we need to have at this table on the power cost equalization fund and the exposure of eroding its purchasing power and its actual value. So maybe when you come back, or even before you come back, you can put some of those historic stuff numbers together for us so we can look at that. I know it takes a statute change for that payout, but clearly if we decide to have a payout that's non-sustainable, then we need to have the discussion of the erosion issue and how we're going to deal with that. And if we're going to have a lower payout, then we need to know the implications of that. So there's some policy work that needs to be done on this because if I can just stop and come back to another question. This portfolio here is basically a long-term time horizon in perpetuity, or a couple of decades out, or some number, hopefully that's going to be around a while. With that allocation of basically 37 bonds, that time horizon is different from the 5-year time horizon earlier under the CBR. on the high risk end of the CBR. So we'll work that out as we go forward.
Right. And on this one, you've looked at the year-to-date earnings, which were good. The fiscal year-to-date, 15.77, and you know, 5 year, as the chair pointed out, at 3.71, and 3 year actuals at zero. And unfortunately, much of the money in this went in approximately 3 years ago, and it was a big deposit made and when PPT was passed, as I recall.
Right, there was an equity infusion.
Right.
But we can also go in and measure that by time weighting our
right.
Cash
well, flow. We can get you returns with that. But you should know that timing was not the best, as it turns out.
Well, we just to add to that, and I know it's kind of off subject. But we did also an equity infusion into the court's retirement account to bring that up to being fully funded. And the timing on that wasn't the best because, you know, the markets kind of did what they did. We had substantial retraction. So we understand that sometimes you have good timing and sometimes bad timing.
Okay, the next one I wanted just to show is the Public School Trust Fund, which has a principal and an income account. And here we have a moderate risk target asset allocation of 43% domestic equity and 57% fixed income. And for the income fund, it's 100% fixed income, because that's where the money gets spent from on an annual basis. Had a balance in 2007 of $362 million and lost money before in 2008 and has gained back up. This fund receives a portion of mineral revenues, just like the permanent fund does, only it's a much smaller portion.
Off of our royalty share.
Of the royalty share, it's like 0.5% or some of the royalties income. I don't remember exactly the number, but it's a small amount goes into each year, and money is spent for schools each year from the income account. You see the year-to-date returns for 2008 at 17.64, fiscal year so far at 12.23. And 3 year actuals are actually positive here at 1.38, and 5 year actuals at 3.59 with forecast at 6.95.
When you come back with the more information, when you do the 1, 3, 5, and 10 and years, could you also put in having a little inflation column? We've got our indexes were benchmarks.
Right.
We've got to watch our purchasing power, and then we want to watch our performance. So we need to.
We should be able to do that.
Yeah, it's pretty standard stuff. So.
And you can see that the income fund, which is all short-term fixed income, so it's basically a cash money market type account. You can see how it's performed over time.
And the payout of this fund, kind of go over that again for us.
This one pays out.
Senator, all the interest earnings and dividend income goes into the public school income account, the account on the right, and that is available for appropriation by the legislature.
And how are the losses allocated?
The capital gains and losses are retained in the main fund.
So it's just dividend income and interest income that's paid out?
Yes.
The next charts show the public employees retirement, defined benefit pension and health trusts, and the teacher retirement. can see a more complex asset allocation for these. And if you'd like to, Gary, if you'd like to go and define what those are, could be helpful.
Senator, the fixed income is primarily broad market, Barclays aggregate, although there are some treasuries and some emerging market debt, a small portion of that. Domestic equity is a number of active and passive managers, and that includes large cap and small cap. Large cap generally companies over $1 billion, small cap, or let's say 1.5 now, but in small cap roughly less than 1.5 billion. International global is two components. One is emerging market, which are companies that are just, or countries that are just starting to emerge into the global economy, and does include China and emerging market. The others are developed international markets. It's companies in international markets that are large cap. So the missing component right now in the international global is small cap international. Real assets refers to things that are intended to kind of act as a hedge against inflation, such as real estate, some energy, timber, farmland, and treasury inflation-protected securities. Alternatives and infrastructure are generally private equity investments, investing in startup companies or in companies where a large leverage buyout is attempted to take place, and this also includes the asset class generally known as hedge funds, where investors are using sophisticated strategies to try and outstrip the market.
Okay, if you look then at market values, need to comment that these funds are both complex funds from a cash flow basis. There's money that comes in on a monthly basis from employers with payroll. There's money that goes out on a monthly basis to retirees. And there are special appropriations by the legislature that have been made into these funds, as well as the earnings and losses in these funds. So you can't take an actual value without having the full accounting and, you know, based on gains or losses, tell where you are, because there's actually, I think, more money that goes out of this fund for benefits than comes in from employers on an annual basis, but then there's additional money put in by the legislature, and then there's earnings. So it's, when you look at actuals, the $11,129,000 at the end of 2007 went down to $8,359,000 and the end of 2008. Much of that is investment loss, that change. And then the increase to 2009 from to $9.5 billion, much of that is investment gain, but not all of it's investment gain. Some of it's a special appropriation from the legislature. Year to date, a fiscal year to date is probably the best one to look at there, the 12.3% gain from July. 3-year actuals with a negative return of 1.87, and 5-year actuals with a positive return. The forecast, the 8.25, is an actuarial assumed rate that these investments are structured to meet that rate. And so that's PERS. TERS is invested exactly the same, or nearly exactly the same as PERS. You'll have a slight difference in returns because of cash flow differences in and out of the funds. But you look there, you had $5 billion as of the end of 2007, down to $3.7 billion at the end of 2008, up to $4.2 billion approximately at the end of 2009. and with returns 12.36 for year-to-date fiscal year, loss of 1.9% for 3 years, and 3.31% return for the five-year actual. Again, with the 8.25% actuarial assumed earnings rate.
Last spring, when we went over the this issue, we asked the Cowan representative that to give us his thought on it, on catching this 8.25% targeted return. And I think this year, what we'll do is ask similar questions, but we'll try to put it in a more graphic detail up on the board. Or as an example, if you take 12 of 07, just on the PERS side, we'll just use as an example of $11 billion. You take that number and you extrapolate it at 8.25%, which is a linear extrapolation going forward. And then you pick up the next year, and I recognize these are calendar years and not fiscal years, so we'll actually be using June 30th numbers when we do it. You take 08 number of 8.3, extrapolate that at 8.25, and then you take 9.5 and extrapolate that at 8.25. I got two concerns. One is, how do we catch the 8.25 in this example at 07? How would we accomplish that if we could? And I've got serious concerns on the 8.25 number as being in, expressed for at least two, if not 3 years at the table, that that number is too high. So, and we're going to, I know that's not the presentation today, but just for the members, that's some of the coming attractions we're going to look at. Is that a reasonable assumption? And if it is, can it be obtained, and how would we obtain it?
Mr. Chair, at the last two meetings at the Alaska Retirement Management Board, that same question has been asked, and we had an asset liability study done by Callan, and we had a presentation by Buck Consultants, who is the actuary for the state, at the at the most recent Alaska Retirement Management Board. I think it would probably be valuable for the committee to have copies of those. Buck Consultants showed an expected return base for their future with a tendency, with a central tendency around 8.46, and so there's, it's inconclusive whether the 8.25 is right, wrong, but it's something that certainly many other people are concerned about the same thing and have been looking at this. The Retirement Management Board has certainly made this a priority to look at what the correct assumptions are, and we have information from them that we can provide the committee.
And just if, on this subject, if you hold everything else constant and you change that number from 8.25 to 8, our liability exposure increases. If you take the rate of return from 8 to 8.25 to 8.4, it's going to shrink that number, everything else being constant. So it has some repercussions on some of the forecasting and the targets that we use here. But we'll have that debate in discussion at the table, and certainly give them the opportunity if they want to put down 8.4 on the table. But I guarantee you that it's going to be an interesting presentation.
Mr. Chair, the 8.4 was certainly not a recommendation. In fact, I think the actuary actually did not recommend that we go beyond the 8.25. In fact, suggested that maybe an eight was more reasonable in their opinion, although they didn't base that on anything except for their conservative feelings. We would certainly not suggest that the 8.25 is too low.
Okay, good.
So I just wanted to make sure that you.
Yeah. And I know it's not. It's, I know, just, it's a different board, and you know they.
It's a math.
They've got some autonomy and stuff that, which is good. Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Under here, under the PERS and TERS, your forecast is 8.25, which is invested under moderate risk. But when you go back to par cost equalization, the forecast is lower. But those are at high risk. why is it that it seems, when I think about high risk, I think about the potential of higher rate of returns, medium risk, lower rate of returns, and low risk, even lower rates of returns. Why the discrepancy between these two then?
I can't completely answer to the chair, to Senator Hoffman. I can't completely answer that, except that the retirement funds do hold assets that are illiquid, which could prevent you from being able to meet your payout requirements in a smaller fund. For instance, say things like farmland and real estate, that because of the length of term and the amount of and the scheduled cash flows, they're able to hold different some asset classes that are different than what are held in the PC endowment.
As an individual that is a beneficiary of PCE, looking at these numbers, I would rather, just in conclusion, it would seem though as though I'd rather have the power cost equalization at a lower risk category with higher forecasted returns, as is in PERS and TERS.
I understand.
I think if we can put a finer point on that question, I think Senator Hoffman is what he's alluded to. There seems to be an issue we need to discuss at the table as far as definitions.
Right.
And where we have high risk defined, you know, as on the power cost equalization and high risk under component part of the CBR, along with something called moderate risk under PERS and TERS. But so I think we need to take a look at that. So we use the same definitions across our different account holdings. Liquidity is a major part of the risk exposure.
Right.
So as they go into these investments outside of stocks and bonds, into alternative infrastructure investments, if it's farmland or other illiquid real estate type holdings and real estate assets that are illiquid, I would expect that to have an impact on the risk exposure just from a cash flow standpoint,
right.
If nothing else on the valuation standpoint, on what actually is farmland worth when there's not transactions going on to put a value on it. And on the real estate side of that, probably not of the PERS and TERS, probably best for them, but if you have any the real estate assets, what kind of assets are they? Leveraged, all equity, skyscrapers, farmland, what are they?
We can certainly get an explanation for the retirement funds, the types of real estate. And I can tell you that we've certainly moved away from leveraged investments in real estate over the past year or so.
Senator, on the real estate investments held by PERS and TERS, 80% of those real estate investments are known as core real estate, meaning institutional-grade properties held in the name of the funds, not in collective basis. And none of them have any leverage on them at all. There is a section of the portfolio that is approximately 20% that are collective funds, and those funds, some of them have chosen to put significant leverage on the assets that they held. So a percentage of 20% of our investments, if you were to follow them through, would be leverage, but not a large percentage.
Okay, we have we've had informal discussions with a permanent fund. I've got to clean the glasses when I deal with you boys, make sure I'm reading the same numbers, you know. One of the concerns, we have upcoming attractions in the markets of a lot of real estate being refinanced and the inability of the banks to refi them and lenders to refinance these instruments. And even though you may pay cash for one, if the guy next door to you goes under, it's going to affect your property value when everything else gets reset.
Right.
So my concern is when we look at these embedded assets, that we have some kind of a feeling for how accurate their estimate is on the market value when and if you have to liquidate them or when you go to liquidate them. Clearly, there's less risk when you pay cash than when you leverage, but I think we're going to have some coming attractions of how they're going to get these commercial properties refinanced over the next couple of years that are coming due.
Senator, you are correct, and that, as I said, that is really manifest in the collective funds. Where we own the assets as a separate account and in the name of the fund, and there is no leverage, it is true that, you know, if your next-door neighbor gets marked down, then your property is probably worth less, too. Those are marked to the market. They're no longer the accounting convention of, hold at cost and only write them up. So they are marked to the market by recent changes in accounting rules that kind of followed the Enron debacle. They aren't immediate mark-to-markets. They usually trail by at least 3 months, but they are pretty close to what the market is in that area.
And just for the record, Senator Passman, who just stepped out from it, he joined us some time ago here in the meeting today, and I forgot to mention that. But anyway, we'll be asking that question to the permanent fund when they do their presentation, and also the other more liquid asset classes that they're in, alternative investments and so on and so forth. So we'll get a better explanation, but we'll get a more detailed review of that and as we go forward.
Okay, the last slide I wanted to show you is just the Permanent Fund Corporation. And as far as their asset allocation, I'm not going to give you definitions of what those are, and they use different definitions on their most of the descriptive pages. Now they've gone to a risk-based analysis that shows their asset allocation differently than this. But if you look at values here, it was at $38 billion at the end of 2007, down to $28 billion at the end of 2008, to $34 billion at the end of 2009. As a fiscal year-to-date, return of 14.3%, 3-year actuals of negative 1.25%, and 5-year actuals of 3.48%. And their forecast return is at 8.28%. So they're just slightly more aggressive than the retirement funds in terms of their forecast. But they are going to be giving a presentation to your committee, I assume, at some point. So we'll let them speak to themselves. But this shows the values for comparison purposes. They've done very similarly to the retirement funds over the past several years.
And we'll take a look at that. And one of the concerns we had a few years ago is looking at the PERS and TERS portfolio, which has a shorter time horizon than the permanent fund. And it has a payout that has to be met, the retirement account, retirees, so on and so forth. Or the permanent fund, you either get a dividend or you don't. And there's, we go along with the market flow. So there's quite a bit of differences between the two. But the retirement accounts had a higher risk profile than the permanent fund. That was 2 years ago. We can go back and dig that out, but we're going to put that back on the table because that is a concern. And I see here you got, there's an 8.28, which is a bigger number than 8.25. We recognize that little mathematical quirk, but there's more to the profiling of the risk exposure than just the return. So we'll take a look at that to work through that detail.
Okay. And then the very last page in my presentation here is a question to answer a question that Senator Hoffman has been asking, which is when we forecast in the revenue sources book, we're using a combination of actuals and forecast. Which, how much of it is actuals and how much is forecast? So if you look here for FY10, the actual unrestricted earnings through 12/31/09 were $82.8 million, and we're forecasting an additional $101 million through 6/30, for a total of, for the revenue sources, of $184 million. And then
so if we could just stop for a second, Paul, because I haven't had a chance to look through these charts. So the 182.7, that's your gain for the year?
That would be the 184.1, which is the total FY10, would be the estimated investment earnings, primarily general fund, unrestricted earnings for FY10. And of that, through 12/31, of the estimate of 184, we'd earned 82.8. So we're slightly behind the estimate for the first half of the year. And then on the restricted investments, which is money that stays in the CBR or stays in subfunds and of the general fund or endowments and trusts that we manage, and in the permanent fund, the forecast earnings for the year was we're forecasting another $1.7 billion total earnings there, but we've already earned $5.91. So this would be, going to the question that Senator Hoffman asked about the forecast versus actual. The $1.7 billion in the restricted earnings there is for the forecast is based on the forecast earnings as presented in the carried out for the last 6 months of the year, assuming that they earn at that rate. So you can see the restricted earnings have done very well for the year. The unrestricted earnings have been just slightly below target.
We've had an exceptional rebound since April.
Since?
Take out January, stop in January.
Right. And today the market was up another percent, so who knows. There's a still tremendous amount of volatility day to day in the market.
Mm-hmm. Any further questions from? Well, what I'd like to do is over the next couple of weeks or so, get with individual members a little bit and kind of see where the committee members' areas they'd like more detail, and then I'll have the staff get with the administration, and we'll go back and start taking a look at some of these issues. And we'll take the CBR as one subject matter. We'll take the power cost equalization as another one. We'll have a presentation by the permanent fund on errors, and then we'll have a presentation on the retirement accounts on the values and stuff there. And then we'll try to piece this together, but we'll have to kind of work on how we're using these definitions so they're across the board, and so when we lay everything on the table, we understand the risk exposure or the volatility or what have you of what we're actually dealing with. Anyway, I'll work with the committee members in there through this process. Do you have any final comments from the commissioner? I want to come up and thank your staff for taking all the harder questions.
Yes, as you can see, I've got good people working for me. And Mr. Chair, we're happy to come back and provide you with whatever information you request, and look forward to working with you and the rest of the committee members to provide you with a good look at what these funds are doing and continue the discussion with regard to how they're managed.
Thank you. And we'll have The next meeting will be Wednesday, 9 a.m. We're going to have the DOT Deputy Commissioner of Aviation to give us an update on Ted Stevens International Airport, which would give us a good feeling for how much of an economic rebound the Anchorage metropolitan area should feel. Again, that ripples through the rest of the state. And then we're also going to have the Alaska Railroad come in and talk to us about, you know, what they see around the state and how they're doing. So is there any, Senator Ellis?
Mr. Chairman, when we have DOT before us on the subject of the airport, is that the appropriate time in your view for me to bring up my discontent with DOT and the backlog of projects and lack of transparency in that whole process?
It could be if it was dealing with the aviation side, because there's two big divisions in DOT. So the presenter will be the deputy in charge of aviation. So it may be a subject matter when we actually bring the highway guys in and get an overview of what projects are that DOT has on the books and what kind of throughput they're getting.
Well, I'll be polite and listen to the presentation about the airport, but I'm chomping at the bit to get into the backlog and the softening economy and what DOT isn't doing to move things forward.
I will express that to them so they're better prepared when they do their presentation.
Well, don't give them too much warning.
Well, I think a list might be nice. You know, they can give us some data points on and stuff. I think.
Well, it's absolutely impossible for a layperson, let alone a legislator, to figure out what's going on over there. And I hope the Finance Committee, I hope you'll put your authority before getting some answers.
Mm-hmm. We'll be asking them some hard questions, I'm sure. They have a potential, or the state has a potential of having another stimulus funds on the table here, assuming that the U.S. Senate and the President sign it. It could be in the ballpark of $180 million. So there's a whole other list of projects. So we're going to have not only that issue that you're bringing up, but how are they going to implement these other projects, and their timeline is to have 50% of them under contract in the first 90 days. So we've got that. If that comes to fruition, and we're going to have a discussion on that at the table here, and then how does that impact these other projects that have already been on the books, and where are they?
I just figured, Mr. Chairman, if your top-notch staff couldn't get answers and couldn't figure out, you know, past projects at DOT and where the heck are they and why aren't they on the street, you know, from years ago, after 5 years, you know, if things aren't obligated, they go back to the general fund or have to be reappropriated to stay alive. And we're approaching that on many projects that people have lost track of.
I think what we've found, or at least what I've found working in the legislatures, is, you know, we're the appropriating body, and we appropriate, and for instance, and we'll use Anchorage as an example, we appropriate funds for a particular project in Anchorage. If DOT doesn't want to build it, they just don't build it.
And we never hear a peep about it.
Mm-hmm. So it is a point of agitation for virtually every member at this table. I would imagine our newest member won't be long before he connects those dots. And there is concern about that subject matter. And also the communities that go back and get particular earmarks from Congress on road improvements in their communities, and the lack of enthusiasm for moving those forward, even when they have the funds, and we do our part here by appropriating it for those road repair. So there's room for discussion with the agency on that and the administration.
I appreciate that, Mr. Chairman, and it's not just some personal pique on my part. It's a community concern. I've heard it from other members of our caucus, if not all of the members of our caucus. So I'm hoping the Finance Committee will give a sharp point and a focus to that in the near future before we run out of time this year.
Okay. We'll work on that.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay. Any other questions or concerns? I'd like to thank everybody for coming. We'll see you Wednesday morning, 9 a.m. Meeting adjourned. 7 minutes after 9 a.m.